Hello, thanks again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from CelticUnderground.net. This is a football fans podcast and I'm Harry Brady. Going to keep the intro short and sweet this week. This week's guest is a journalist, and for those of you who are online, he is liked by few, loathed by many. I was going to say loved and loathed, but the love bit I'm not sure about. Anyway, if you're not online, Twitter, Facebook, or whatever, then Ewan is just simply a football journalist and golfing journalist at The Guardian. He's also a Hearts fan, so we have quite a ramble of a podcast. It was recorded the day after the Bayern Munich game, so it starts at the Bayern Munich game, goes off onto loads of other stuff. I think it then comes back to Celtic and touches on Hearts and Rangers and Sevco and Airdrie and architecture and everything else in between. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it, and I'll speak to you later. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Ewan Murray. So I'm joined by a person who will probably have me slaughtered for having him on the podcast, since his official Twitter handle is Hurting Hun from some. I'm joined by Mr. Ewan Murray. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent, thanks. Now, before we get started, I always have to set out somebody's footballing supporting credentials, more relevant with yourself, since some people often say stick to golf.
I say to myself, stick to golf.
What was your first game, and who was your first hero?
First game was Hearts against Motherwell, Scottish Cup tie, 1987, I think. It was a 1-1 draw. Hearts won the replay. I remember it vividly. I've still got the tickets in the old main stand at Tynecastle. I remember my mum warning me about the bad language I was going to hear around me. I remember being scared at the height of the old main stand at Tynecastle. We're sitting at the back of it. I don't remember much about the game, but obviously I looked back and saw what the scores were. My first hero was John Robertson, who probably still is my hero. I'm not sure that changed. But yeah, we lived in Edinburgh then. My dad supports Kilmarnock, and my dad watched Kilmarnock every single week at that stage. Yeah. But they were in the first division, bottom end of the first division. So he was going to Airdrie and Brechin and whoever. It was the first and second division, yeah, bigger then. He was going away there every week, and whether I didn't have any interest in going or whether I wasn't allowed to go, I never were in the primary school support at Hearts anyway. I don't know what it was, but the first game he took me to was Hearts, which was a local team. And funnily enough, I saw Kilmarnock a lot after that, but Hearts has stuck because that was the first team I'd seen, so nothing has changed.
He didn't mind doing that, even though, well, I suppose he wouldn't bother. He was in the other way, that Kilmarnock pipped Hearts for the title.
My dad was there, 24th April 1965. My dad was behind the goal watching Kilmarnock as a 14-year-old boy. So, yeah, and we've got a picture in the house. My mum and dad live up north now. My dad's still got a season ticket to Kilmarnock, never goes. In fact, my mum gives him stick because he refuses to buy a pensioner's ticket, which he'd be entitled to, because he says it's a donation to the club. He keeps buying it and never uses it. But no, and funny enough, my dad had little time for Hearts because late 70s, early 80s, Kilmarnock and Hearts kind of yo-yoed out of the Premier Division.
Yeah, I remember that.
And there was quite a lot of nastiness and trouble between the two sets of supporters, which I think he had a boot in the back of the legs once, and he was told at Tynecastle once, watch your back on the way out and stuff like that. So it wasn't as if he was ever going to push me into watching Hearts, but that's the way it worked out. And as I say, the first team was the first love and the one that stuck, so that's the way it played out.
So you're obviously best known as being I'll put down sports journalist. What would you say you are? A football journalist, a golf journalist, or a sports journalist?
Yeah, sports probably fair. I mean, now 70% of my time is probably golf. I enjoy doing football now far more. I did football full time. I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it, but yeah. Coming out of that and only doing little bits of it, I enjoy the football working environment more. Maybe there's just a freshness to it. It's different from doing golf stuff. And, Yeah, sports writer is probably one of the nicer things I've been called, so we'll stick to that.
So how did you get into being a sports writer? How did you get into being a journalist?
It's funny, I get emails from people asking me about this, and I'm anxious on two levels of replying. One, I think I'm far too young to guide kids as to what to do, and two, there's no set way to do it. And I'm always anxious to say, look, here's what I did, but please don't think this is the way to do it. I was lucky in that it was pretty much always what I wanted to do. As soon as I started thinking about jobs, I wanted to write about football then. Mm-hmm. I loved reading football match reports. I loved reading football interviews. I had a real attraction to it from a young age. So what happened was I won Scotland Sunday, used to do a Young Sports Writer of the Year competition. Mm-hmm. And I won that under 16 or whatever it was. I was still in school. So that made me think, okay, well, maybe I can do this at a certain level and I should stick at it. I didn't want to do journalism at university in case I thought it was maybe too vocational, in case I didn't want to do that when I finished.
Right.
So I did history at Edinburgh, and the Scotsman and Scotland Sunday were really good to me. They kept in touch, and I probably kept pestering people that I'd met, you know, through that earlier competition. Mm-hmm. So I used to go in and do little bits and bobs when I was at uni, but then I needed formal training. So I got into the big thing was I got into Cardiff University as postgraduate journalist scheme, different sections: newspaper, magazine, broadcast, public relations, which only 30 people. Per sector get into. Mm-hmm. For a year. It's kind of there in City Uni in London at the time, were the best two in Britain that was seen as. And I got into Cardiff, and I was there for a year. And from there, really, you think you're going to get a news reporting job and you'll get a good news reporting job from that course. But I'd been at The Guardian and work experience in the sports desk, and unbeknown to me, they wanted someone new to do Scottish football at the time I was finishing in Cardiff. Mm-hmm. And gave me a phone, said, would you take this on? It was initially a freelance thing that I didn't know what it was going to come to, and that was the start of it. And also, again, luck, Kevin McCara grew up across the street from my mum in Clarkston, so I'd always kept in touch with Kevin. Kevin was at The Guardian then. I loved Kevin's writing, admired Kevin so much, and I dare say he put a word in, you know, a good word in for me, but that's what started the whole thing off.
So you started doing that. So you said they were looking for someone. Were you replacing anyone specifically, or were they just augmenting the team?
Well, Graham Clark did it before.
Right.
He wrote with The Express for years and various others. And that was difficult for me. I mean, you then realise you're replacing someone that's... And I'm a new kid on the block, really. I mean, I'd done freelance stuff with The Scotsman and Scotland Sunday. I'd done some things with Sunday Herald, just match reports. But, I mean, I was a new kid. Mm-hmm. And I thought, God, I've suddenly... It wasn't his only job, but I've taken this other guy's gig. Mm-hmm. So I had to make sure I spoke to him. I said, look, I'm sorry, really. And he was absolutely fine. He was great about it. He said, listen, no, it's fine. It's no. And that was that. But that was an early, I thought, you know, not an eye-opener into the ruthlessness of the business, but you had to think about other people that were involved in it, you know.
Yeah. So how did you then get into... Well, first of all, actually, you're a newspaper at The Guardian, that's very different to being at The Record, The Sun, even The Daily Mail. Mm-hmm. How different is it being at something like The Guardian compared to a more traditionally Scottish-based paper, if I put it like that?
Yeah, it's slightly hard to say because I haven't worked in them. And what I'm always quite conscious of is that the tabloids, particularly in Scotland, seem to get a bad rep, and tabloid football writers, and these guys do a brilliant job. And almost without question, I believe tabloid writers could write in broadsheet newspapers, no mm-hmm. problem, they could do it. I couldn't do the reverse, and I don't know how many others of our broadsheet guys could go the other way. So I think their talent sometimes gets underplayed. In terms of Indigenous Scottish papers, obviously your market's different. Mm-hmm. You have to explain things a bit more, even to the office at times, and make them aware of, like, this might be a big deal, this isn't a big deal, this, because they don't see it as much. But it gives you, I think, a bit of breathing space, and that every cough, spit, fart of things that sometimes you don't need to cover, you can avoid. And I've enjoyed that part of it. Again, not to at all demean anyone who does do that cough, spit. It's just different. But you can be a bit more selective about what you do, and then obviously try and gauge what you think should be covered properly and what you think you could leave alone and what you could. So yeah, but they're great to work for. They've been great to me. I think they're. I mean, they wide the way so many things digitally in terms of, you know, sports coverage. Mm-hmm. And they really, it's like a global news outlet, really. Mm-hmm. Not just sport across the board, the way they cover things. So it's an exciting company to be at.
So how'd you end up being golf guy for the Guardian?
I sort of linked to a famous Celtic fan, of course. So I used to do... I was interested in golf. Mm-hmm. And when the Open Championship came around, I think I said to the office, look, I would like the chance to go and, you know, help out. And Lawrence Donegan, obviously, was the golf correspondent.
Yep. Uh-huh.
And I didn't know Lawrence, other than I met him at Christmas do, and he was great to me, so I really enjoy your stuff, and blah, blah, blah. I knew who he was, obviously.
Uh-huh.
I had Lloyd Cole and the Commotions vinyl records that my mum had. so... I then basically helped Lawrence out. I was his number two at the, or actually number three or four at the Open, and then I went to the Masters and was kind of back up. And whenever Lawrence wasn't doing golf, I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And Lawrence was absolutely brilliant to me. But then it was difficult because I always thought Lawrence is a fantastic writer. And used to look at his work and think, God, how could I ever? You know, journalists have that. I think we look at other people's work and think, how could I ever write as well as that? And Lawrence has so much talent.
Mm-hmm.
He just had an aptitude for it. And he was great. He really encouraged me, great to work with. And then, quite suddenly, actually, he announced he was leaving the Guardian. And then I don't want to sound arrogant, but it seemed like a natural progression for me to go and become the golf correspondent. And I said I would like to do it, and they said they would like me to do it, and that was it. So the kind of balance of what I was doing swung around to doing, as I say, probably 70% golf now and 30% football.
So how does it work in terms of do you have the main sports editor directing what golf events you go to, or do you then say this is the calendar of events that we as the Guardian should be covering?
Yeah. So as much as you can. I mean, basically I do that. I go down at the start of the year, or the end of the year, and have a catch up in the year.
I'm just thinking about, sorry to interrupt, the reason I'm thinking that is because I'm conscious of the fact, and we'll get on to how your industry's going, that football journalists in Scotland sometimes now report away European games from their TV because the papers don't have the budget to send people here, there and everywhere, and here you're a golf correspondent, get to fly left, right and centre. So that's what I was asking.
Well, that's what the conversation is. The conversation has to be, I say, look, I think we should do these events.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done it now for a few years, so I know what things cost, I know what might be expensive, I know what we should and shouldn't do. The difficulty is, suddenly a tournament could become very important because Tiger Woods has won the week before, or Tiger Woods is coming back from injury, or you can't really plan out the whole year, so I try to do it in chunks.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, yeah, I say, look, I think we should do this. If there's a saving needed to be made, maybe don't do that and do that, and it's just a conversation. But as I say, the template I've done has been the same. I've done this since 2012 now, so it's pretty much the same thing I do. In terms of covering things from your TV, obviously, I think it's a difficult practice because then if everyone get into that habit, then why would anyone send you anywhere? I think you still have to have the value in going somewhere and seeing people and finding things out and being on the ground. But I understand the way budgets and finances are, and listen, The Guardian's not immune to that, that everywhere you have to be. You have to be sensible and have to be conscious that you're not wasting, you know, your company's money, and that's no use to anyone. And you won't do it for long if that's what you're doing.
So how do the Guardian then deal with the fact that they've got a Scottish football correspondent?
You'd be amazed how well
he's not there for half the time because he's.
But you'd be amazed how well it does. It's very, very rare. Recently, for example, Rangers played Celtic. What was the score? 2-0 game.
Mm-hmm.
At Ibrox, and I was in America. That's actually the first time that's... I don't just mean that fixture.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first time that fixture's happened and I'm away somewhere. But, I mean, it's amazing how I can still do Scotland's international games. I can still do... I've done all the Champions League games. There's very, very rarely a clash where you think, I've missed something that I really should...
I suppose the main events of the American and the European tour are over the summer, aren't they? So
I'm going to Dubai a week on Sunday for the golf. Well, my only annoyance is because Hart's stand has been delayed, I'm going to miss the first game in that new stand, which is a real disappointment to me. But generally, I'd like to think I've been there to cover everything that needs to be covered. It's just a balancing act, I think.
How do you see your industry's changed in the time that you've been doing it?
Yeah, I mean, I've only ever known, I suppose, the digital era, inverted commas, is what I've come into. You know, you hear about the older days, but even within that... you know, I had this idea that a broadsheet sports writer would sit back for the afternoon and, you know, let your thoughts percolate about whatever piece you're going to write and take as much time as you want. And it really isn't like that. I mean, you really don't get much time to sit and breathe and think, and because we're in It's the balance between a 24-hour news environment and making sure that your analysis is salient enough and deep enough that people want to, to read that. And I think I've seen it with my own company. There's a balance between, do we want to throw everything up online immediately and that's what we want to do, or do we want to back off from that a little bit and take a bit of time? I don't think any news outlet has really completely mastered how the digital age should work. No one's properly developed a model. And if you started again, obviously, you wouldn't have everything for free to start with.
No.
It's not very hard to charge people for something that they're used to getting for nothing.
Do you know, I was thinking that just last night. We can touch on the Celtic Bayern Munich game in a minute. One of my favourite things that I talk about the challenge of playing Champions League football is I always remember, I've mentioned this umpteen times on the podcast, I always remember Neil Lennon saying the challenge of playing a game after a Champions League game was not, yes, you put a lot of physical and mental exertion went into playing a top side like Bayern Munich, but it's also, you are on such an emotional high, having played that game, that you kind of get to sleep that night.
Well, I'm the same from work. When I'm sitting talking to you, I didn't get to sleep till 3 o'clock this morning.
So the problem for them playing on a Saturday is actually just general fatigue from not having slept and things like that. But at the same point, I'm flicking through the telly at midnight last night because I'm the same thing. You're on a high after being in the
game. It's an adrenaline thing, isn't it?
Not to get bored too much detail, and it's a roundabout way of getting back to your point about everything being free. We've all got smart TVs. And I never use anything of it, so I went on just to see, and there's an app where you can rent the most up-to-date releases, whatever it was, $5.99. I was just thinking about how 20 years ago you thought nothing about going down to the video shop and hiring a video and spending £2.50, £3 hiring a video. Now I looked at that and thought, I wouldn't be spending any money renting a film. And that's an example of how things have gone for. We accepted 20 years ago, we paid for that. We now live in an era where that should be free.
That's right. And also, I mean, if you look at it as a, I'm not a businessman, but as a business model, newsprint costs next to nothing. People buy adverts for it. Money. I mean, newspapers the newspaper product should be a brilliant business model to make money.
Yeah.
But then if you do, you know, you then get into the area where it's been given away elsewhere for free, blah blah blah, it undermines the core product. And, you know, it's all, as I say, no one's properly squared that circle, and it's really.
No, and the problem, you made the point there about when do you release stuff online because the value you're getting from people going to your website, and I often think that about.
Well, you can read news stories in a tweet, can't you? I can read a tweet that tells me.
It'll summarise
an entire story in 140 characters to the point I don't need to read the story.
Yeah.
So and so's injured. So and so's. Requested a transfer. I don't need to. It's that way. I don't even need to click on the story. I know what the story is from the tweet.
But the other aspect of that is, so a story breaks at 2 o'clock. Story breaks at 2:30 in the afternoon. So we read on Twitter the basics of the story.
Yeah.
And whatever, whether it's main news or sports news, and then if it's a big story, meat's added to the bones of that by 5-6 o'clock, and so you then. Through the course of the evening, you get more meat on the bones. You watch the news at 10 o'clock at night, and you've got even more information to it, and you maybe read it just before you go to bed. If you then buy a paper the next day, there's a part of you thinking, that's an old story.
Yeah.
Because you've read it, you've consumed so much about it in the previous 12 hours.
And professionally, you have to be careful. I learned quite early on, you have to be careful that in the mad rush to get something up or done early, you don't get information wrong, and you don't. You know, you have to be clear that however quickly you're doing it, that what you're saying at that time is right. So that was a kind of skill that's more important now, I think, than ever. As I say, you don't have the time.
I mean, the other reason I ask that is because one of the things I've noticed from when you hear interviews or see interviews with older journalists in particular, and is this concept of, particularly in the tabloids, they seem to be having to be at their desk in the office. And obviously that's a complete contrast. It appears that the olden days was they spent the whole time in the pub chatting to people and getting sources. There must be a balance that you've got to.
Yeah, I think the old thing. I think the old thing now, like a lot of things, is probably overplayed. I think that idea of them drinking for 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, I think that was overstated. However, even that culture or an element of that culture you couldn't get away with. There's too much pressure at work that you could do that anyway. You'd have too much work to do. But I hope, and I don't think, The culture of going out and meeting people and finding things out, be it socially or however you do it, I mean, that's a core journalistic skill. I hope that's not gone. I don't think it has.
No, but the challenge for you guys must be, I mean, I've had the good fortune for our podcast of meeting Brendan Rodgers three occasions now, getting 10 minutes with Brendan Rodgers. And people then say, how's Brendan Rodgers? And actually, after the first time I met him, I said, you know what, see, I wouldn't like to be a journalist trying to get stuff out of Brendan Rodgers, because he's been through a media schooling. It's not too warm, it's not too cold, it's not too sunny outside, it's not too wet outside. He's just been to a media school of, he knows how to have his talk and not say anything that you guys can then hang a massive... He's the opposite of Pedro Cassinha.
I don't know. He says things. I think your point would be fair is he's not going to say something silly.
Yeah. Just in terms of the
but you get managed,
people at top clubs are then, they're getting media training.
Oh, absolutely.
Which then makes them, from the club's perspective, better at handling the media and not land themselves in it. From your perspective, then, it's the complete opposite because they become bland.
Yeah, I don't find him remotely bland. But what I would say, if you ask him a silly question, he will see your silly question a mile off and tell you it's a silly question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he can put you down like that. He's smart. He gets it. But but there are managers, typically I'm struggling to think of one, but I could, who would talk, and you would come away saying, "Oh, that was good." Then you go back through the tape and think, "Actually, he's not said anything."
Mm-hmm.
Brendan Rodgers isn't like that. I tell you, one of the first times I met him, he had a go at me. He pulled me up.
Right.
So he'd, in fact, that was in America then. Celtic were playing Manchester City last year.
Mm-hmm.
That brilliant game, 3-0 draw.
Yep.
And I was at the Ryder Cup. And the office has said, "Look, is there any Celtic theme we could do a kind of feature about around this game?" So if you remember, he'd signed Doris de Vries.
Mm-hmm.
And he made this fuss about how great Doris de Vries was and blah, blah, blah. And Craig Gordon came out of the team. And then on the Saturday against, was it Kilmarnock? Mm-hmm. I think de Vries came off at half-time.
He did. After Kilmarnock had scored the goal for 4 years.
So I wrote a piece saying, of all the things Brendan Rodgers kind of would address at Celtic, this was a strange thing to do. I think Craig Gordon was fine and blah, blah, blah. And I said, my point was, there's a lot of pressure on Craig Gordon in this Manchester City game, because if he has a bad game, you know, where do they go there? It was just an opinion piece. So this is, what, September, late September? Now, I'd been at Brendan Rodgers' unveiling. I'd been around them. I was in at Lennox Town for a press conference a month later. And we're just sitting in the room waiting for him, and he came in. And he said, "I wonder when Ewan's going to write the sequel to that piece." And you know when you're not sure if someone's talking about you? And I looked, I was only Ewan in the room.
Uh-huh.
I said, "Me? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is that piece with Craig Gordon? How I destroyed this goalkeeper's career." And I said, no. I said, "I didn't see you destroyed anyone's career." No, he's, now he's back in the team, and now he's back in the Scotland team. He said, "Maybe you'll write this sequel piece about how it was great management." Now, listen, 10 out of 10 at Brendan Rodgers, because he had a go at me.
Mm-hmm.
He was also, he was smiling.
Yeah.
He was laughing while making a point. And I thought, wow. I thought, well, A, you obviously are aware of what people are writing. B, good on you. If you've got a problem with that, you're going to say, "I disagree with that." And C, the way he did it was, it was funny.
Yeah.
And that was one of my first, and listen, that was it. He's been brilliant ever since, and we got on fine. But it was an early insight into how he must think and work. And maybe from his point of view, making it clear that, you know, if you write something I think silly, I'm going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've not got free rein to, not that I would think that way, but you've not got free rein to write what you want. So
yeah,
his point with that would be, of course, that Doris de Vries coming in boosted Craig Gordon to the point where he obviously did improve.
Yeah,
which is absolutely fine.
Which is the purpose of it. Although I've also been told, you know, Celtic fans seem to be taken aback because Doris de Vries had three excellent saves when he played against Dundee recently. Mm-hmm. And the point that was made to me was, that's the Doris de Vries who's in training every week. He just, when he first came in, when he came into the Celtic team, just did two or three games where he didn't play particularly well, probably not helped by one of his first games being against Barcelona.
Yeah, and the manager said, Brendan Rodgers said that he's been upset when he's lost two players in his career. Remember this quote? He said, "Luis Suarez and Doris de Vries," when he left Swansea.
Right.
So, I mean, it was this, he was built up, and I thought, wow. Now, again, Brendan Rodgers will inevitably say this was the management of getting the increased performance out of Craig Gordon, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
So great, but it was, it was funny.
So we're speaking, because there's a few things you touched on that I'm going to go on to, but since we're talking about Celtic and Brendan Rodgers, speaking the day after the Bayern Munich game, so as an esteemed member of the Scottish Football Writers Pack, How did you see the game last night?
I thought it was an excellent game. I thought, even including Anderlecht away, which I was at, I think in large spells that's the best Celtic have played in this campaign. My point in Munich, and I get criticised for this, I think Celtic are a better team than how they played in Munich.
Yeah.
I don't think they played to their potential. And last night I thought James Forrest was outstanding. I don't remember him playing as well as that.
Yep.
Callum McGregor, I'm going off on a slight tangent, but I've got a theory that Brendan Rodgers' bigger achievement at Celtic has been improvement of players he inherited, even over players he's signed.
Yeah.
Obviously Dembele's been a massive success. Sinclair's been a big success. I think Ndouri's out and a few others, but to me, the way he's improved, I mean, remember James Forrest looked like he was going to leave. Callum McGregor, who I never really fancied, has come on leaps and bounds. Stuart Armstrong's come on leaps and bounds. You could go through them.
Scott Brown has turned into a player. Last night I was watching that thinking, if I was a mid-table English Premiership team down, I'd be thinking, could I get him? Because they're all about the next 18 months, because that's the length of time a manager's in charge.
But I was thinking,
if I could get Scott Brown in my team, I've got a less chance of getting relegated, which is all that matters, bottom half, middle to bottom of the English.
Listen, Lustig's another one. Tierney, obviously, who you could argue was going to be an exceptional talent anyway, but to me that shows how good a manager he is, that he improves. A lot of those players are completely flatlined under Ronnie Dyla, to the point where if they left, I don't think you guys would have been that worried about a lot of them.
No.
So to me, that's a sign of a really, really good coach and manager, that he improves. And the good thing is they're Scottish players, obviously.
That was the thing. I was sitting looking at the team last night. It was the six starters could play for Scotland of that team. You know, when we talk about when we decry Scottish football and how poor Scottish football is, and here we were lining up in a Champions League game where more than 50% of our starting 11 could start for Scotland.
Depending if Scott Brown says he wants to play that game or not. The other point, sorry, so for all that praise, for all that, I thought Celtic were excellent. They lost soft goals, and you can't lose goals. Dedrick Boyata might get away with that mistake in the Scottish top flight, maybe.
But
you won't get away with it at that level.
The thing that gets me, and this is the really frustrating thing as a Celtic supporter, Dedrick Boyata wouldn't make that mistake in an SPL game.
He would, you just might not notice.
The only thing I could think of is he thought he was deeper than he was. Because if you think you're deeper, you let that go over your head because the keeper's going to get it. There are no other circumstances you let that go over your head.
And Coman, to be fair, is one of the quickest footballers I've ever seen. But, you know, for all the praise, which I think is entirely legitimate, it's the ultimate shooting yourselves in the foot when you lose bad goals like that.
PSG, we would get beat by PSG.
I would write the PSG games, the segment of the same, I would write them off.
But if you were to look at the point I was going to make in isolation, I think if we'd have played as well as we did last night against PSG, we might have only lost 3-0 or 2-0.
Yeah.
Now, I know that doesn't make any difference in the grand scheme of things, but in terms of building the confidence of the team to play Champions League European football, it does make a difference.
I agree. What's important is it's only 2 weeks since they played in Munich.
Yeah.
And as I say, I thought Celtic were really poor and made fundamental errors. Didn't lay a glove on Bayern. And we all accept a good Bayern are. There's no... But you have to do yourselves justice, I think, and I didn't think Celtic did. So that improvement, again, within such a short space of time, and OK, they're playing at home, but and Bayern are missing a couple of players, but that was really noticeable.
He made a marginal tweak to the system. In Scottish football, we always play a four at the back, but Tierney goes up. But if you, against Aberdeen 2 weeks ago, which was Bayern and Aberdeen were our two best performances this season. There's two connections between those two games. One, it was more of a three than normal against Bayern, and a straightforward three against Aberdeen at the back, and Dembele started both games.
That's where Celtic have been unlucky, because they've not, we're talking about whether it's just signed defenders or not, but they've not had the first choice centre defensive pairing to play in Europe. And Dembele's set, is the way he holds the ball up, the way he can hold opponents off. You saw him when he came on in Munich towards the end of the game. That's the level, nothing against Lee Griffiths, but there's a real difference with Dembele at that level. So it's a shame they haven't had him in.
Yeah, I know Munich took the foot off the gas at 3-0 at home, but we did play much better.
Absolutely.
And actually hit the post, hit the bar, and had a goal chopped off that on another day could have been on.
And someone like Scott Sinclair, I don't think he's had a very good season generally. He came alive with Dembele on.
Yeah.
And you know, it just shows.
I actually thought when Dembele came, I actually texted a mate a couple of mates after Dembele came on in Munich and said,
now is the start of Dembele being our first choice striker for the rest of the season until he gets
but he has to stay fit. That's the thing. You can't keep him in these stretches of play where because that undermines so much of what he does. So I hope he stays fit and keeps playing, because any team, he's just the physicality, the power, and he inevitably can't be up to full speed yet. He hasn't played enough football, so undoubtedly he makes a big difference.
And then the point at the back, I think last night was the first night that you could say the failure to sign centre-halves in the summer cost Celtic points or cost Celtic a result in the Champions League, because we would have lost to Munich anyway. Although, again, we've lost five goals to Bayern Munich, and four of them, I would say, are soft goals that without changing anything about the dynamic of the team, we should be able to not lose those goals. But even so, we'd have lost to PSG, we'd have lost to Bayern, and we beat Anderlecht. Last night was the first time that not signing centre-halves could have had an impact on the result.
Although, centre-half makes a mistake. Again, that could happen. I don't know, I find it interesting whether there's a balance to be struck between not signing players, obviously, for the sake of it, and a perception thing with a club, not just Celtic, a club has to be seen to be trying to, I mean, in the eyes of their own fans, to improve and to...
There's a famous quote from Jock Steen when Celtic signed Ronnie Glavin from Thistle in the 70s, where sometimes it wasn't necessarily about signing a player because he was better than what you've already got. It was signing players to give the fans a lift and to make the squad see that you're not going stale.
That's what I mean. So if there's a perception you're trying to close the gap to Bayern Munich, for want of a better phrase, and it's a difficult balance. And I say that, I don't think you can argue with the way Peter Lawley and Celtic run their club. I mean, if I was a Celtic fan, I'd be delighted with the way they look after the financial affairs. So it's very hard to argue with what they're doing. But I said at the end of last season, I was unsure if that defence, that central defence especially, would be good enough to compete in Europe. I thought that needed supplemented then, and nothing's really changed. And I think, I mean, Simunovic is, again, his injury record suggested he wasn't going to stay fit for a long enough period of time.
I was just going to say, it's compounded when there's two centre-halves who are telling the coaching staff when they're not fit. That's compounding the problem, if maybe they are fit.
Right, you said that, not me. I'm not casting aspersions. I just mean, if you look at Simunovic's, look at the number of games he hasn't played. That to me would suggest, well, we need someone, because he's not going to play 40 games a season.
Yeah.
He's not going to play 30 games a season. So,
They're looking to try and bring in two centre halves in January.
Yes. I mean, when Brendan spoke to us after Munich, he basically said that's something we'll need to look at. And his argument all along, which again is difficult to contradict, is I'm not going to sign players for the sake of signing players. So I understand that. Now, if Celtic finish third in this group, this is exactly what they should do. Well, as you say, has it made much of a difference other than this perception of should they have more centre backs? But if they finish third, I would argue that's a good achievement.
What I find interesting, actually, from a wider Scottish football perspective, is because one of the things is Brendan wants, if we've only got a small pot of money, he's got to spend it on a select number of players, and more of our younger talent's got to come through. So the players that we've got potentially coming through our system. So we had Tierney when Tierney was identified as perhaps the best young prospect in European football or something 4 or 5 years ago, I'm sure he was a striker, or a winger or an attacking winger, and Celtic converted him from a winger to a fullback.
He's also conspicuous by his absence in Scottish youth team.
Yeah.
Setups.
Calvin Miller was a winger who Celtic are trying to convert into a left back.
Yeah.
Tony Ralston's a right back who Celtic are trying to make him more of a defensive right back, because in youth football he's been an attacking right back. You've got, in our youth system, you get McEnroy, a defensive midfield player. You get Ewan Henderson, attacking midfield player. You get Conor Hazard's a goalkeeper, but he's Northern Irish. And we've got Jack Aitchison and Mikey Johnson as attacking players. Point I'm making is, you just go around that team of where our potential talent is. Winger converted to fullback, attacking fullback, trying to make him a bit more defensive, a goalkeeper, midfielders, strikers. We, by just the nature of it, hoover up the best talent in Scottish football youth level. There's no centre-halves being quoted is coming through our system.
It's funny that though, because
and Scotland's biggest weak spot in the national team is no centre half.
Yeah, although I think across Scottish football in general, actually, there's young players. I'm wary of, you know, speaking about the Great Leap Forward because we've heard it so many times. But in general, across Scotland, from under 19 level down, there's a lot of really, really good young players. I go and watch Hearts youth teams quite a lot, so I'm again on Sunday, and the younger ones, 17s, there's a batch of them who are excellent. And a bit like these Celtic guys, they've played together all the way through, mm-hmm. so they know each other's games and they feed off each other. Now, I don't know, clubs would have their own idea about what ratio of those players they want to get in the first team, but I think
you've got a 16 year old at Hearts at the moment playing first team football.
Yeah, Cochrane. I mean, he plays for Rangers, mm-hmm. I think Billy Gilmer was in front of him, and he, you know, Hearts are like Rangers still really good young players. So Hearts argument previously would be there's young kids at Celtic and Rangers who aren't going to get a game there who could play for Hearts first mm-hmm. team. The problem being the compensation figure that's due. They can't just come and join another club, so they have to leave and you pick them up.
Yeah.
So Cochrane had left Rangers and Hearts got him. So Brandon, who's played for the Hearts first team, he was at Rangers as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they have other guys who've come all the way through their own system who, as I say, are excellent. So I think there's maybe something happening across Scottish football that there's an undercurrent of really good young players.
The only thing is, in my 40 years, but more specifically the last 30 years of being a football fan, we've had these peaks of of players up to 19. So what do you think is the issue that from 19 our players are not... I mean, it's not like, you know, you can always get a... You always have a group of... We were talking before we came on about world soccer having a top 50 players in Europe from 10 years ago. And you go through that list and some of them you've never heard of and some of them have made it. And you're always going to get that.
Yeah.
But it's not even as if you've got some of these... And there's five of these young Scottish players. None of them seem to make it to... Yeah, a lot of them make a half-decent career kicking around Scottish football at...
I had a full and frank discussion with Peter Lowell about this one. This was a few years ago. We were talking about the academy system. And Peter was saying how Celtic's academy does well because there's players all over Scotland. And I said, Peter, surely Celtic's academy is to produce players for Celtic,
mm-hmm.
not for Hamilton or for Raith Rovers or for... And we had a good... I got on really well with Peter and we had a full and frank debate about what the role of the Celtic academy was. The other thing, the difference at a club like Celtic is... And where a manager like Brendan Rodgers is due credit for playing young kids, there's immense pressure to win every single game.
Mm-hmm.
If you play young boys and you lose three games in a row, well, there's meltdown, isn't there?
Yeah.
So you have to be careful.
There was a lot of Celtic fans irritated that we drew with Kilmarnock on Saturday. It was the third time we've drawn at home because it's the third time that Brendan Rodgers has fielded.
And yet, the young guy Johnson, who's excellent, he gets a chance to play.
I did a calculation. The average age of six of our first teams of... If you just took six of our starting 11 on Saturday, the average age was 19.5 years of age.
Yeah. Well, and Neil, if you've been blunt about it, it's a draw. Well, so what? Celtic are going to win the league.
We're going to win the league by 20 points anyway.
Yeah. Now, that is why, and I think the same will apply at Rangers. If they play young kids and then there's two or three bad results,
mm-hmm.
people are shouting and bawling about. So you have to be careful how you do it. And that's a distinct problem with clubs of that size, obviously.
But it's also the way teams play, because we played an equally fringe team. I think, for me personally, one of the things that would enhance Scottish football is if we had a bigger top flight.
Yeah, I agree.
And I use the example of when we played Kilmarnock with virtually the same type of fringe team in the League Cup, but it's a cup competition, so Kilmarnock have got nothing to gain with just not getting a doing.
Mm-hmm.
So they play to try and win the game, their space, and these young players, who are good players, play in the space. And we scored goals.
Mm-hmm.
We then play the similar type of team against Kilmarnock in a league game where all Kilmarnock are interested in is not getting a doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Steve Clark built a reputation at West Brom for being organised.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well, that's allowed, right?
I mean, I'm not criticising. I'm just saying that's the challenge. That's why I think a bigger league would help that.
No, I agree. Listen, you're preaching to the converted about a bigger league. I mean, I find the split a nonsense. I find four games a season a nonsense. From personal experience, and you know, the year Hearts win the championship, okay, they're winning every week, but see, going to Dumfries, going to Falkirk again, going to Kirkcaldy, going to different places, and Hearts took huge supports. Again, the team was winning. It was different. I remember saying to my mates, we'll be back at Motherwell next season again, thinking this is the same as... There was no sense of occasion, no sense of.
I mean,
if you have a bigger league and play each other twice, I think that comes back.
I'll move Aberdeen out of the Hearts rather out of the conversations. See, Kilmarnock and Motherwell, right? Two teams have been in top flight for a very long time. If you've got a team who are marooned at the bottom of the league, and so Dundee look like they're starting to be that team this season. So very quickly into the season, you know you're staying up. As you say, well, what's exciting about Kilmarnock fans going to Motherwell? Two mid-table teams who know that maybe slightly different this and Motherwell doing something, but in general, two mid-table teams who are going to finish mid-table. Where's the do that four times? Where's the excitement?
No,
and then the other point I've made for years is when the old Rangers used to be successful, a team like Hearts giving it a go, but you're not as good as Celtic or Rangers. So you play three games, four games, and you're on a bit of a winning run. People saying Hearts playing well, then you go to Celtic Park and you get beat.
No, that's right.
And it just wipes the legs from under you, and then you start building a bit of momentum. Five games later, you play Rangers at Tynecastle and get beat.
Yeah,
wipes the legs and same again.
You can't prove this, but I think there would be a perception of teams getting closer to the top. I think that's right. And also, if people say there'd be too many teams in the middle of the league, well, if that gives breathing space to play young kids there, well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
I always go in about. I remember the season Mark McGee had a good season at Motherwell.
Yeah,
and it was his first season he'd taken the job. And I remember hearing him at the end of the season saying he was on off the ball with Tam Cowan and stuff, and he said he went to see Gretna and realised that no matter how bad Motherwell were, Gretna would finish below them in the league. So because of that, that gave him the freedom that he knew he could play. He could give it a go every game because he thought the fans would rather win three games in a row, lose two games, win three games, than draw lots of games in a row. And since he knew Gretna would always be worse off, he could give it a go. Motherwell played more attacking football and actually did well.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was the biggest argument for a bigger league. Because there was a mid-table manager saying, I knew for certain there was going to be poorer teams than us, so we could afford to give it a go.
Yeah. Here's a slight tangent. I've been looking at Motherwell's squads the last few... Motherwell were doing very well. Well, the weekend they had four Scots in a squad of 18... Two of them started. They played Dundee the previous Wednesday night. Three Scots, one of them started. I know Cadden and Campbell are good players, but that is the argument there that they're doing better because they have English kids and loanees from elsewhere and whatever else, one from Blackpool and whatever. Or is there an argument that they should be, they have an obligation to play Scottish players? When they're successful, it probably is against that, and you'll see what they can do, what they want. It's working.
They have an obligation to win games to their supporters.
Exactly. I just found it interesting. I found it interesting a few Scots were in their squads.
But, so, you know, having a bigger league, if I then get onto your team, or your city, first of all, for me, my ideal would be, obviously, Celtic romp away with everything, right?
This isn't a Wallace Mercer point coming up here, is it? About amalgamation.
No. I actually think it would be really good for Scottish football if you then had the next tier of Aberdeen, Hibs, Hearts, and Rangers, maybe. I couldn't care less about them, but I'm chucking them in since they exist. Competing for second place and having a real competition for second place in Scottish football.
Yeah.
And for me...
There's a competition for first place, not...
Oh, you see, I want us to romp away.
I get that.
I'm not interested in a competition for first place. But if you then had competition for second place in Scottish football, at least that's better than nothing.
Although we do
and
have
you're
that.
Starting to see that from,
We do have that just now, don't we?
Well, that's what I'm saying. You're starting to see it. And I think that's why... I sense quite a lot of enthusiasm from the people who go to games every week. There's a lot of enthusiasm about Scottish football. You get Hibs selling, your mate Lenny is selling out, doing well at Easter Road, and when you guys finish your 1960s retro office block. So there's a question.
I had to text the manager of Hibs at the end of last week apologising that my phone had been broken for a few days after the Derby result, and he came back with a laugh.
How do you think he's doing at Hibs?
Oh, very well. I said at the start of the season I thought Hibs would do well. He's a good manager. They've got good players. There's also that slight crest of a wave thing about they've just, you know, they've come up, they won the cup the year before. I mean, they've had, you know, good times, I suppose, for Hibs, relatively. But I'm pleased for Neil because he had a hard time at Bolton. That ended up a bit of a disaster.
He was in the position that lots of football managers find themselves. They leave a job, they don't get a job, and then they suddenly notice their name getting mentioned less and less, so it probably gets to the point of thinking, I better take a job.
I don't know that, but he has an inherent thing where he wants to work, whether it's his I don't know, working class background, whatever you, not a phrase I particularly like, but whatever it is, but he wants to work, he doesn't want to sit around. He was doing media work, and I think he's very good at media stuff, but that wasn't, he wanted to get back in. And I remember when he got the Bolton job, I remember speaking to him and he was excited about it. You know, he thought this was a club that was, that had bad times and he could get them back up, and he didn't know the extent to which, obviously it transpired, the chairman was very ill and the money was all getting stopped and it all became a bit of a mess. And I felt sorry for him, because if you go back to that, I still remember that brilliant night Celtic beat Barcelona in the last 16. He showed himself as a really, really capable manager. The players Celtic unearthed at that time and made a load of money from. And I thought, you deserve better than this. And you know, this will sound a dig at Hibs, but I don't mean it. If he has to come backwards to go forwards again, then I think that's...
Well, that was, I was going to say, not to decry Hibs, but how do you think a manager who... He wasn't sacked by Celtic.
No. He could have been back at Celtic.
How do you think he's ended up going down to Hibs?
Down to Hibs in terms of
standard of managing, you know, you'd have thought what he achieved at Celtic, Champions League football, that you would have had top half of the English, you would have had better than Bolton at the time that Bolton came in for him, would have got him already.
Well, that comes back to the perception of, it's still the perception of Scottish football elsewhere. You can't get away from that. And Neil even did that in Europe, and Van Dijk and Wanyama and all these players. And to me, his reputation should have been sky high. And there's still a thing in England where they say, ach, you only manage in Scotland. And this is where, funny, a few of us were talking about it last night, it'll be fascinating as to where Brendan Rodgers, whenever he goes eventually, where he goes. Now, he's different because he's managed in the Premier League and he's managed a very, very big club in the Premier League, but it'll be fascinating as to where he goes back. Inevitably he'll manage in that league again, but at what level.
He needs Celtic to achieve something in Europe. I'm not saying win a trophy, but he needs Celtic, I think, for him to get to the standard that he would want. He needs Celtic, and in more than one occasion, I think he needs Celtic to get last eight, last four Europa League level. Last 16 and Champions League.
The point is, Brendan Rodgers has been great for Celtic. Celtic have been great for Brendan Rodgers. I mean, I still remember he was a kind of wounded figure that the last stages at Liverpool. I don't want to use the word dishevelled, but you could just tell a manager with the weight of the world on his shoulders, and he's come up here. And he loves it. He loves the club. He loves the city. He loves where he's working. He's got complete control of what he's doing. Things have gone, I would imagine, beyond his wildest expectations right from the start. But Celtic have reinvigorated him the same way he's reinvigorated Celtic. It's not often you get that, a complete perfect match between club and manager at the right time. I think this has been one. What was your question? Maybe I a complete tangent again.
Back to Hearts. So on your team, Hearts.
Or the main stand.
So why did you go for a 1960s retrofit?
That stand looks fantastic. Honestly, when you stand at the back, and I was there again, I went for a walk around on Saturday, the stand looks fantastic.
From the pitch up?
I've not stood on the pitch. When you stand behind it, when you stand on the pavement and look at it, you get
blown away with the side. Photos of it looks like something you'd find in North or South Lanarkshire Council.
Listen, I'm not touchy, I don't care, I'm not an architect, but I thought, well, I've laid these pictures about the back, what does the back of the main stand that... Easter Road look like? I bet you don't know. Or what does the back of the main stand at Rugby Park look like? Or what does the back of the main stand at Tannadice look like? No one knows, do they?
Well, it's not the back. I mean, that's the main entrance. That's the main entrance. That's where you make a statement about who your club is.
Well, what does that look like at Easter Road?
A typical bar built Lego brick stadium.
I don't remember anything getting said about that.
I know, but it's, do you know what it is? When you get someone like Anne Budge coming in and saying we're going to do everything different, and then Bills are 19.
I'm just concerned about the window cleaning, Bills.
I know, of course. We're
not going to be able to, we're struggling off the same players, and we're not going to be spending however much a year on
How does it manage to be so late?
I think they were massively...
That's not minor mistakes.
Listen, it's been embarrassing for them. I think they were my theory at the start was they should have gone to Murrayfield and played a season. And I think people would have, we'd all have bought tickets on the basis. I was completely against going to Murrayfield permanently, obviously, years ago. But if they said to supporters, look, help us out, we're going to have to go for a year and we'll get it all done in a season, people would have gone, and you'd take the hit. They might have finished 7th in the league or whatever. But the argument against that, obviously, was the costs were really high, and it would have added to already what is an expensive project. So they tried to rush it in. And listen, the other teams in the league were brilliant in terms of moving fixtures that they didn't have to do. But I think now, I mean, it looks, to all intents and purposes, it looks done. So I think they'll be fine now for the game on the 19th of November. But It's been a combination of circumstances with Hearts, with the Ian Castle thing, not being able to play games at home, with the way with the stand, bang. There's just been a whole lot of factors that they haven't quite kicked on the way they hope, where I would have hoped they would have done.
So I'm trying to remember exactly where you were on Castro.
Well, my point, which will now get it gets thrown back in my face, but I really objected to the noise around his appointment. I thought Hearts, I mean, Robbie Nielsen had far less experience in coaching than Ian Castro did,
mm-hmm.
and Hearts appointed Robbie Nielsen, and by general consensus that was a great success. And the noise around Castro, who was perceived as this kind of geeky, I don't know, I objected to that.
Do you not think that's part of what holds Scottish football back, is that Luddite anti-educational concept?
Yeah, I didn't like it, and I didn't like it especially from people within Scottish football, Chris Boyd, Stephen Craigan. I mean, they're employed by other clubs,
mm-hmm.
and they were very quick to have a go, and I thought, well, that's not on. So then the other thing is, no one specifically said what he wouldn't be able to do and what a problem would be. Now, it turned out he recruited really, really badly in January. Players weren't suited to Scottish football. In training, he was training players. It was like Champions League level training.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, to the point where they weren't fit enough because we're doing all this...
technical.
Yeah. But it was too much for the players he was dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And three, and Craig Levein spoke about this publicly, he didn't get the basics of how to win games in Scotland, which is actually quite straightforward. Celtic play differently. But other teams, you win second balls, you make sure you win the ball,
mm-hmm.
get the ball wide, get in the box quickly, repeat, repeat, repeat. It's not cosmic how Scottish football's played. And he didn't... Hearts played as if other teams were just going to let them have the ball and they didn't have to win it back. It was amazing to watch in spells as to how jaw-droppingly bad it got. So it just didn't work. And I give him credit because the game with Dunfermline, the League Cup game at the start of the season, when you knew this, the whole atmosphere of the ground was such that this isn't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
At least they were quick in saying, OK, let's start again. But it's cost them time. It's cost them at least, you know, 6-8 months in a first-team building context.
So text I got on Saturday was, if you think Rangers are bad, you should see Rangers. So how do you think... No, I'm just telling you what the person said.
Hearts were terrible on Saturday. Well, no arguments here.
So how do you feel about Craig Levein being...
Well, I'm his biggest fan. I think Craig Levein's great. I think he knows what he's doing. I think he'll sort it out. But as I say, he's had a combination of things. The ground, a load of injuries, bad recruitment going back a while, which I know he's not completely blameless over. But it's just a bit stop-start. But he'll get... Craig knows what he's doing. Despite he gets hit with this, obviously the Scottish international job didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But as a Scottish Premier League manager, he knows what he's doing. Unless, for the years he's not been in it, he's lost his touch, but I don't believe that. He's been at the club since we came out of administration, so he's been around the scene. He knows Scottish football, he knows Hearts. I think he'll get it right.
And so is he there now as the manager? Or do you think this whole thing of he's the director of football and then he stepped into the manager's shoes is an easy out if they then decide to change it, that he can say, well, it was only a temporary measure and he steps back up to the director of football?
No, I mean, they gave him a 3-year contract to manage the team. The thing is, a lot of the stuff, I could bore you a bit, but I've seen it, a lot of the youth stuff that he put in place, the Hearts Youth Academy had been dismantled via the mismanagement administration and whatever else, and he's completely rebuilt that, and it's excellent. And all that was really done. So the director of football role actually either was going to have to change under a new manager, because he didn't have much to do,
mm-hmm.
or you wouldn't have one, or whatever, you know. So at the start, I had a conversation with someone who said to me, by far the best qualified guy at manage Hearts is Craig Levein. But none of us thought he would do it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think he had any interest in managing again. Where it transpires, obviously he did. And he's single-minded, Craig. You know, there's not this theory that he would get pushed into the dugout.
Oh, I mean, to be fair, that's one of the things I have heard, that's a criticism of him as well, that he's maybe a bit too... single-minded and he's right always.
Yeah, he said that himself. He can be stubborn, would be the word. But that can also be quite a good managerial trait. And I've not found him to be wrong about many things, to be honest, in football. But again, I'm maybe biased. I was a massive fan of Craig as a player. Got to know him as a manager and as a guy. I'm a huge fan of him as a guy. He's quite like Neil Lennon in the sense that there's no bullshit when he speaks about football. You know, mm-hmm. he's the kind of buzzword at the minute, pragmatism, but I mean, he doesn't go in for all this fluff and noise around it. You know, he sees things. You know, he can discard rubbish and see things for what they are. Neil Lennon's very good at that. And yeah, I think it'd be fine.
The thing that struck me about the way two recent football clubs in Scotland have been dealt with by you guys in the press, not you specifically, but the press, was the heavy criticism of Cathro.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the director of football doing? What's the director of football's position?
Well,
permanently.
Say, we've heard nothing about the Rangers director of football, is this?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've made this point myself.
Rangers don't... As I understand the way football clubs work, the director of football is the director in charge of the football division. Mm-hmm.
He's a line manager, basically.
Line manager, yeah. So he's the guy who sits in the board to report to the board on the football division. And so, that's why then if you've got a culture of changing your manager more regularly, that you can keep the culture of the football division constant while you just drop in and out coaches.
Yeah.
That makes sense if you want to be changing managers more rapidly. So if Rangers don't have a director of football. Rangers have got a chief scout who's been given a director of football title.
Well,
it's the way it's coming across to me.
The first alarm bell there would be when they appointed the director of football after they appointed the head coach.
Yeah.
Well, that's the wrong... I mean, you're going to put a new system in place, that's the wrong way around,
mm-hmm.
for a start. And then I thought it was funny this week. I mean, myself and I think a few others wrote... I think I called him the invisible man in print this week, Mark Allen. You know, where has he been?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we get an announcement about a new... It's just a scouting team, really.
Mm-hmm.
And we get an announcement about who these scouts are going to be. I thought, OK, fine, well... But he, in theory, should be heavily involved in the hiring of a new...
Well, if he's the director of football...
Head coach, stroke manager.
He should have... His name should have been on the bottom of the statement when Kashinya got signed.
As Craig Levine's was with Ian Cathro.
Yeah. And...
To answer your question...
You should have his mobile telephone number. And any time I see discussions about the potential Rangers manager position... I should be seeing you guys saying either a direct quote from him or...
You wouldn't get that.
It's believed that...
Listen, he maybe does speak to... He's not a guy I have any cause to deal with, but he maybe does speak to guys in my industry. I don't know.
I've not seen any evidence from anybody that he's spoken to.
But to answer your question, I think it's pretty obvious that Craig Levein had a profile in Scottish football, and a lot of the stuff about him, including from punters, actually, Scotland fans, I still get a lot of this, is quite personal against Craig Levein. It's because it's Craig Levein.
Mm-hmm.
And no one can forget that night in Prague. And whereas Mark Allen or whoever it might be at another club, it's not a club thing, but he's not known.
But how many clubs have got a director of football?
Hibs do, don't they? Is that George Craig's title? I think it is. Yeah. But
look what Jock Brown went through when we had a director of football.
I read his book. Did you read his book?
I had him in here for a podcast and it lasted so long I split it into two. And what people don't know is that was also with bits edited out. Afterwards he thought he'd maybe gone beyond the legal position of what he could have said about one or two people.
Yeah.
So that's fair enough, and you know.
Yeah. Again, well, that's probably the same. Jock Brown was known to people in Scottish football and would be an easy target on that. I think that's been common.
Yeah.
I mean, Gordon Smith got a lot of what I would regard as personal stick when he was in various positions, and that's because he had an existing profile.
I can't remember which Rangers it was that had Gordon Smith as the director of football, but when he was there, he was a point of contact. He was the director of football. You saw quotes from him because he was the go-to guy to get a statement from the club.
Mm.
I mean, it seems to me that the go-to person to get a statement, well, not the go-to person, the person that you get given the statement by is Jim Traynor. I mean, to all intents and purposes, he would be their director of football.
I don't know about that. Also, the Smith analogy is probably more fair when he was the chief executive of the SFA. Again, I think there's a thing in Scotland where people with existing profile, dare I say negative profile,
mm-hmm.
are very easy to get hit upon. I think Craig Levein basically suffers with that still.
So where do you see Hearts going once you're back in Tynecastle?
I think this season they'll do okay, but they need to, again, they're massively short of players, so they need to overhaul it. It'll be next summer before they can change that completely.
But surely the director of football has an input into players.
Of course, that's what I'm saying.
He's got guilt to bear on your squad.
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. He's not completely exonerated from... I think... He probably the players they signed, when you looked at it last January, didn't really have Craig Levein's fingerprints on them at all. If you looked at who they were, the ones that Ian Castle signed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, probably then he should have been more, you can't have it both ways, he should have been more influential actually in January. Now, luckily they signed all these guys on short term deals and they could just let them all go.
Yeah.
But he probably should have been more influential at that point. You could tell with the makeup of the team and the players, they weren't Craig Levein type players. Whereas, you know, a couple they brought in the summer was more like what you would expect. But I don't like the phrase transition, but they're kind of in that just now. As I said, there's been a lot of circumstances that they've had to.
It's a bit like when Celtic had Tony Mowbray, pretty much from the Christmas on, you knew he was going to go. So you really just. And probably even more so in the latter part of Ronnie Dyla's period, you knew he was going to go. There's an element of supporter of you just wanting to get through this season because you know things are going to change at the end of this season.
Yeah. Tony Mowbray's one. So I think the managers are a member who visibly, the strain on Tony Mowbray by the time he was going was visible. I mean, he was in press conferences, he was. I think Tony Mowbray seemed a really nice guy, decent mm-hmm. guy. But the strain of the job at Celtic, for I think multiple reasons, was visibly too much for him, and you could see it. He didn't look well. Mm-hmm. You know, it was. Ronnie Dyla had a more outgoing personality.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought he was much good as a manager, and I made that quite clear from the start. But again, by the end, you could tell the strain of the job was getting to him. Paul Le Guin was exactly the same at
mm-hmm. Although at Paul Rangers. Interesting, old and new Rangers. Twice they've tried a different manager to have a different style of football,
mm-hmm.
and both times player power has won. People who run Rangers seem quite weak. Because the first time the players won, under Barry Ferguson yeah. and Chris Boyd and the likes won.
That didn't
and then this time Kenny Miller's won.
The only thing was Le Guin.
And Lee Wallace.
Le Guin at the time when he was brought into Rangers was, I mean, that was a massive coup.
Mm-hmm.
I think Peter Lowell spoke about it. I mean, the Celtic thought, oh, wow, we've got a problem almost here.
Yeah.
He was, but then his career afterwards, actually, he's never really.
Do you know what I said to someone? Because did he go straight from Leon to Rangers?
Yes. Well, he announced he was leaving Leon, didn't he?
Yeah. Because
the theory was, who was the previous Leon manager who went to Tottenham? Was it Perrin or was it someone else? Was it another French manager? Anyway, the kind of cynical theory was actually Le Guin had inherited what was going to be a really good team at Leon. And that would be borne out actually by what happened next.
I remember after he left and being away in the January, February, he was on a skiing holiday. And the skiing instructor was a Leon fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asking about Le Guin, and he said that Leon is. Leon was like a Formula One racing car that was better than every other car on the track, and it didn't matter. Provided you put a half decent driver in it, you won the races. Yeah. That was his point. And so they never really thought Le Guin was as good as everybody else thought.
That's annoying. I'm not sure it was Perrin. There was a manager before I went to England. I think mm-hmm. it was him. What Le Guin did, and I referenced this in a piece last week, Le Guin did what Cascina did and what Castro did. He signed players who visibly were not suited to Scottish football. Who was the centre back? Svensson, I think, the Swedish mm-hmm. guy.
Yeah.
He's too soft.
Yeah.
There was a string of players like that. Clement, the midfielder, who was quite a nice player. He wouldn't have the physicality to play in Scottish football. Now, you can say that's wrong and it's a shame, and but it's a reality. You have to sign players that can play in the league.
But it's also the difference. Brendan Rodgers came in and signed one or two players.
Mm. Now, again, to credit him, now he understands, he should understand British football.
Mm-hmm.
But he's operating at a completely lower level of finance and player identification than he's used to working at
yeah.
at Liverpool. So he had to adapt. That was an adaptation which he's obviously successfully done.
But where I think even managers in Scotland who've done well in Scotland and gone down to England and bombed,
mm-hmm. and there's a lot of them,
one of the things they do quickly is recruit people from back up in Scotland because they know those players.
Tommy Burns did it at Reading, didn't he?
Tommy Burns did it at Reading. I remember Jimmy Nicol went to Millwall and did it.
Well, it's a punter thing, isn't it? Because the first thing, pardon my language, but if you're sitting in a stand at any club in England, the first people they'll turn on will be these fucking Scottish players that have signed.
Yeah.
They're the ones that will get it.
So McKenna's brought in a raft of Scottish players at Bristol City. Mm. And I think I think the other thing that Le Guin and Cascina and Cathro did was bring in a whole raft of players to be my players.
It's just not suited. I mean,
if they're not working, the failure of the players becomes so interlinked with the failure of the manager because they were your players to fit the way you wanted to play.
That's right, exactly. I mean, and to me, it's quite a basic point. You sign players that can operate in the environment you're playing in. You would do that anywhere else.
Yeah.
But that was what all these guys didn't do.
So, kept you long enough.
Well, you're fine.
And I'm just, the other thing I want to touch on is your online persona.
Yeah, completely unfair, isn't it? The abuse I get.
Do you know what I have to say?
Am I on here as part of some? Is this me trying to what's it called? The people that try to clean up their kind of Google history or whatever it's called. Is this my start of my redemption process?
Yes, it is. Yes, no, you know, normally I can't be asked with people who. Well, two things that can't be asked with on Twitter, and as not everybody listening to this will be on Twitter, but two things slightly can't be asked with Twitter: people who take Twitter far too seriously.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also people who then go the opposite extreme, normally, of people who then, as a consequence, only ever go on Twitter just to troll people and rile people and get people. And at times I do feel you tend to sometimes be, unless I'm misreading you and you're a diddy and you know bugger all about football, sometimes I feel you're sticking stuff on Twitter just to annoy people who take Twitter too seriously.
Yeah, well, it proves a point, doesn't it?
It does.
Absolutely, admit.
Yeah.
Normally
I can't be bothered with that type of person, but for some reason I actually find it amusing watching people get really riled with stuff that I think, well, he's either a complete diddy and knows bugger all about football, or he's just doing that to rile you.
It's like a social experiment, isn't it? How people... Listen, I'm saying I don't care. People ranting and raving and shouting and bawling on Twitter really doesn't bother me. The minute I'm going for a pint and someone's trying to whack me in the head with a pint tumbler, that'll be a problem. That's never happened once. So, and a lot of the abuse and stuff I actually find really entertaining. It makes me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff I would block or stop is if it's boring and dull and incessant, the same stuff, I can't be bothered. But people are funny. And yes, it's a good laugh. That's my whole point. It's not serious. It's a internet thing, you've got 140 characters at a time. It's not the Oxford and Cambridge Debating Society. I mean, I don't know why. Anyway, it's probably... The interesting thing is when I tweet about golf, almost universally you don't get anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't. Golf's not a tribal thing anyway, but even at a Ryder Cup, or even if you say you hope someone, Tiger Woods, wins a major or whatever.
Yeah, but I've also found your golf stuff tends to be a bit more down the line anyway.
But the golf is a bit more down the line, isn't it? Aye. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, you're hardly going to say, you know...
But if you mention, well, one of the ones recently I accidentally got bombarded with, Barry Mackay, I knew he was going to Nottingham Forest, and I tweeted, Notts Forest, I've signed Barry Mackay. I got bombarded because it's Notts, it's
Notts County and Nottingham Forest.
They object to Notts as an objection, as a
abbreviation.
Now, we would say, I think I would say Notts Forest, but
yeah,
whatever you do, internet rule number 1056, don't ever mention Notts Forest. Like an afternoon getting bombarded with people from Nottingham about this offensive term. So you get stuff like that accidentally. But as I say, the abuse doesn't... I find a lot of it funny.
Do you get it more? Because obviously the thing is, I follow you, right? And all the other people that I follow are Celtic fans.
Yeah.
And so in general, I'm really only seeing the Celtic fan interaction with you. I'm not really seeing Hibs or Rangers or Hearts fan interaction with you.
Aberdeen, I get a lot of abuse from them.
Do you?
Yeah. I guess I was slagging off their poor crowds. Like, they're a bit better this season, but I thought their crowds last season were really poor.
Well, so here's my interest, and people on this will know my interest in stuff about. There was one day, you know that way sometimes you're a bit bored and you think, God, see if you were doing a clean sheet of paper, you'd completely redo Scottish football. I mean, personally, I'd have, like, a top league of 18, second league of 10, everybody else who had zero value to our game. When was the last time Montrose, Forfar, Stenhouse, Muir brought a player through who then went to Falkirk, who from Falkirk went to Celtic or Hibs?
That model's broken. Although they have a value, those clubs, but not at that... I agree with that. Not at that level.
No, they have a community value, they should be allowed to find their own level.
Exactly.
No, which is not...
They have a real serious community value, a lot of these clubs.
And I know they're only getting £20,000-£30,000, but if there's 20 of them, each getting £20,000-£30,000, that's a big amount of... The problem, for me, we've got a professional game and an amateur game, but the amateur game's being kept semi-professional when it shouldn't. We should cut it free and let it be an amateur game, and the professional game be maximum of 28 clubs.
If you know some of the stuff that goes on with the players in these lower leagues with their contracts... Basically, they don't, you know, the PFA have been pretty big on this in terms of no holiday pay. The contracts get stopped in May and restarted. Yeah. And
well, that's why they're all on 1 year contracts that finish in May. But
and these guys, professional inverted commas footballers, would be better stacking shelves.
Well, I know a guy who played for a second tier Scottish football team, who were once in a blue moon and got promoted to the Premier League. Mm. It's a friend of a friend. And every time they got promoted to the Premier League, he would become, at best, a sub. And every time they were in the second tier of Scottish football, he was, most of the time, a first-team starter. So when he got to about 25, 26, he thought, stuff this, got a full-time job and went and played junior football. And his joint income from that was much better than and the manager of that team couldn't believe he'd made that decision. But he knew he was never going to make it because they played three or four seasons of Premier League football as a fringe player who at best was a sub. Immediately they dropped down, he was first-team football player. So he's a standard 11.
There's examples. Rory McAllister, who's scored tons of goals for Peterhead in the last few years, he's a plumber and electrician. He maybe could have stepped up, lives in Aberdeen, and thought, no, I'm going to get a trade and work and play for Peterhead. And the same thing, he'll earn far more money than he would playing full time for Falkirk, for example.
Yeah.
And how long are you going to play full time for Falkirk for? The other thing I disagreed with was that, I mean, a pyramid structure is okay in theory, and it's okay in England. It doesn't work here.
No.
The geography doesn't work.
No.
Here.
But my point being about blank sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And you would just pick. It stems from, I used to do a job where I'd come across Wetherspoons. And Wetherspoons rolled out their first whole raft of pubs because they basically got the English 92 league teams and said, if a town's big enough to host a team who plays full-time football, it's big enough to have a Wetherspoons pub. That was their mentality. So I thought, based on the same principle, you would just get... And the problem with Scotland is, actually, we should have a team in Shetland. We should have a team in Orkney. And then...
That'd be a good trip in the supporters bus, wouldn't it?
And then, and then the majority of teams would be a Glasgow and District League. Because it was like, if you go on Wikipedia of towns in Scotland, there's things like Newton Mearns has got a population of 15,000 and Giffnock's got Bearsden's got a population of, 15,000. That's the problem, right? But I then started looking at that and started looking at averages attendances, which pretty much stay unchanged. Aberdeen, on a pro rata basis, are the worst supported team in the top two flights of Scottish football. When they play top... When a town has their teams playing top flight football, it roughly averages 10% of that town's population as the average attendance for that team. Apart from Ross County, where it's 84% of the town's population is the average attendance, and Aberdeen, where it's 5% of the town's population. When people go about fantastic attendance at Aberdeen, they had 13,000 today. The town's got a population of 200,000 people. It's a crap attendance.
Mm. Well, I just think in the way of how well the team... I mean, Derek McInnes has done... Okay, I think the cup forms are very good, but in terms of the league form, he's done, I would argue, everything he could do there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, they deserve, there should be 18, 19, 20,000 people watching them play. It has been a bit better this season. I've been keeping an eye on it.
They bounce between 9 and 13,000 people. Mm. 9 when they're doing crap, 13,000 when they're winning cup winners.
To be fair, that's what I'm saying. It wasn't even very good when they had a great team. So there's obviously a historic. But if I point this out and go back to Twitter, God, you get bombarded. I say to you guys, but you go to the games. Oh, yeah. I said, well, I'm clearly not criticising you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you not think more people should come out and support your team who's doing really well and trying to do even better? I mean, they don't have a training ground, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So that leads to, for some reason, that's a spark of abuse. That's another one. Other areas, no, I think that's pretty
Rangers.
Much it. Yeah. I mean, if you mention, by definition, if you mention Rangers or Celtic, that leads to...
You mentioned right at the beginning of the podcast about the criticism the mainstream media get, SMSM, whatever it is. The biggest reason I see criticism from Celtic fans is how the whole Rangers narrative was dealt with. That, for me, we've always had a bit of a bugbear historically. Yeah. I remember Andrew H. Smith getting a job at the Scotsman and being quite taken aback that it was in the days when Clyde didn't have any coverage of football on a Saturday, in that brief period when they just would chat about nothing in particular. They didn't even do the commentating on the Rangers game off the telly stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was Hugh Keevans and Graham Spears, and they said, oh, congratulations to Andrew H. Smith, it now makes it 5 to 25, which is 5 ex-Celtic employees to 25 ex-Rangers employees in the media, and then moved on to a conversation about how the Football Writers Player of the Year was always used to be a Rangers player because it was full of, I was full of Rangers fans who voted for it, so I was quite surprised about how open
these must be apocryphal tales. But well, Andrew said this himself.
No, this was Hugh Keevans and Graham Spears talking on Clyde about Andrew getting a job.
I see.
Scotsman
before my time.
It's before your time. So the point I'm making is, historically, we've had a bit of a depressor out to get his mentality.
Yeah, I get that.
And that's because, based on what they were saying, we weren't wrong to think that the majority of press were Rangers fans, because they were just, because there was Keevans and Graham Spears on the radio saying they were, right?
I would bow to their superior ages on that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
More recently, I would say our issue has been the way the press have dealt with the whole Rangers story.
But it would be, wouldn't it? I mean, you would have an issue with that. Rangers fans have an issue with that as well.
Yeah, but that's because... But our issue would be, they
feel they were unfairly hammered.
Right, my issue
other
would
people
be
would say they're not.
If the press, I actually think, if the Scottish football have got this sore that will go on forever, because it didn't grasp the nettle back when Rangers went bust, and make the factual statement, legally factual. You go and speak to, as I have done, the firm who are Rangers lawyers when they went bust. Rangers went bust. Which, by factual statement, means the new Rangers are the new Rangers.
So you want to go through the rest of the time speaking new Rangers, old Rangers, new Rangers, old Rangers?
No. You can still call them Rangers, the new Rangers.
If you just call them the new Rangers, it's what? I don't understand. So you want newspapers to write new Rangers and old Rangers?
No, I don't mind them being called Rangers.
Right.
But don't pretend they're the old Rangers. Like, nobody pretends Airdrie are the old Airdrie. They play in the same strip. They play in the same stadium.
Airdrie, aren't they?
Well, they're Clyde Bank, actually.
No, no one calls them Clyde Bank.
No,
they're doing well in the juniors.
No, but the point. But that's the point, because everybody accepts that this current Airdrie is not a continuation of the old Airdrie. To the everybody, this is what everybody accepts. Airdrie to the supporters is Airdrie.
Yeah, is that right? The most important thing?
To their own supporters.
Yeah.
So I have no issue. See, to the Rangers fans, they play out of Ibrox, they wear a blue top, white shorts, they change the colour of their socks.
And 50,000 of them turn up to watch them play.
And they sing the same songs.
Yeah.
So to them, they are Rangers.
Yeah. Is that not the most important thing? That would be my...
Yeah, so that's all that matters. But whenever in my lifetime Rangers win the top flight of Scottish football, that's trophy number one. That's title number one. I can't comprehend, and I genuinely, this is not a, I genuinely cannot comprehend any argument that says that that's trophy number 51.
So that'll be the next almighty row, when the number of trophies, so that would,
that's my point. About,
but that hasn't happened yet, so I mean, you, if you're talking about the media...
No, but when they
then
do a marketing thing and going for 55...
But that's them doing it, isn't it?
And when people in the media talk about the last time Rangers did X... You cannot make reference to that without saying since they were reformed as a new club.
You can.
You can.
Of course you can.
Because people know. Because people do make that statement about Airdrie.
Do they?
Yeah. If someone was writing about Airdrie...
Airdrie's also a difficult example because there's not enough coverage of Airdrie, is there? I
mean, no, but if something happened with Airdrie, people would say that's the first time that Airdrie have done it since they were reformed as a new club. People would say that about Airdrie.
If they got into Europe again, for example.
Yeah. That's the first time Airdrie have played in Europe since they reformed as a new club.
I'm not sure they would.
They would.
It's very difficult to say, but I don't think they would.
I think they would.
The first time they've been... I can't see it happening. If they get back into the top flight, you think people would say this is the first time Airdrie have... They're now called Airdrieonians again. They're not Airdrie United
even. I think people would.
I don't think they would.
When they give the context, I think people would say this is the first time Airdrie have played in the top flight since...
I mean, the other thing with Airdrie is their thing became so complicated. What happened there? I mean...
They went completely bust.
Steve Archibald got involved, didn't he?
Aye. Do you know, I remember reading a thing about what Steve Archibald did when he was at Hibs. So I don't know if you can ever find out from this was true. Because he'd been this big star, he hired a Rolls Royce by the hour, would turn up at training with it, and then go away with it, just so the players would then think, aye, he's the Steve Archibald who's been at Spurs and been at Barcelona.
I know
he didn't actually own it, he just hired it for a couple of hours.
I don't know that, but I know a story about him. A journalist, this is again at the peak of his powers, a journalist agreeing to meet him for lunch, you know, to do a piece. And he'll get lunch, obviously, and Steve Archibald brings his whole family with him. So the lunch becomes a meal for six.
But yeah, he was at Airdrie, and basically was it not a business model of, we'll sign people we can't afford?
They're not signed for. Does Fernandes play there? They were Livingston. I get mixed up.
Livingston, but was it not?
He signed a lot of Spanish. He signed Spanish players.
Was it not a concept that I think a few clubs who went bust tried of?
Yes.
Bring in players you can't really afford because you'll give them a platform to sell them on.
Well, Dundee tried the same.
Yeah, Dundee did the same. Yeah.
And then the stadium with Airdrie was also. I don't know how we ended up talking about Airdrie. The stadium with Airdrie was another issue.
They don't own it. To keep their costs down.
I think it's quite sad, don't it?
And then basically they went bust and then bought Clyde Bank and changed the name of Clyde Bank. This is what I found odd about Scottish football when you compare it with Wimbledon.
Yeah.
And Wimbledon then becoming MK Dons, and a lot of people in English football being dead against it and still critical of that was allowed to happen.
And to be fair to Wimbledon, they go a way down and march their way through from the bottom and are now in the same division as MK Dons, aren't they?
But in terms of the culture of you can't be seen to do that, yet up here we allowed Clyde Bank to be bought over and moved, changed name to Airdrie and moved stadium.
Mm. It would be viewed as the value of the club at that time, wouldn't it? I mean, look at in Inverness, when Cally and Thistle merged, they basically took Thistle's money from the sale of the ground, went and played at Cally's ground, played in blue strips.
Yeah,
painted urinal walls red and black, which were Thistle's colours. I sound sore about this, and Thistle were discarded out of that.
But then that's one of my criticisms. The one thing I would praise Anne Budge about is. Inverness's ground's a shithole. And
yep.
How many grounds in Scottish football are not a great environment to go to? Anne Budge, Petrie and Fergus McCann are the only three people who've spent money have invested in Scottish football.
And the guys that rebuilt Rugby Park, obviously.
But actually invest in Scottish football. The Hart supporters and the Celtic supporters are the only people who have actually invested in Scottish football. Everybody else takes the money that's coming in, have borrowed from the bank, managed to write off debt. They're the only ones that have actually invested in the game, in the infrastructure of the game, to enhance it.
Yeah, I mean, what Anne Budge, without Anne Budge, it was her that had to put up the money to perhaps to get the CBA to get out of administration, £2.5 million. I mean, genuinely, without that money, Hearts would have... liquidate. It was that. So it's then quite a complicated deal where basically the foundation will pay her money back, plus interest, which is fair enough. She works for the club for no salary whatsoever. And then they take over and she gets her money back and out she goes. But she's an incredible woman for the age she's at and the hours she puts in and the stuff she does. And we spoke about it, but she'll be sore. I mean, the stadium thing, I dare say, is a minor embarrassment to her because it's not worked out the way yet. But then my view is if it's a short term pain in the arse, then it'll be worth it in the longer term. I'm interested in this concept about Airdrie though. I'm going to go back home and read about exactly what happened with Airdrie.
But for me, that I would say that's the amongst the Celtic
fans. But I would say Rangers fans still bemoan the media coverage, and there's two sides of that. One, Rangers fans feel the media were and are overly hard on their football club, and two, and I find this one strange, there's an assertion that if the media did more to expose, then Rangers would never have ended up in the state they were.
That's a nonsense one, because they shoot the messenger every single bad guy. Well, they've currently got a bad guy. I mean, I sent a text to my mate saying, you've got a guy who's a convicted fraudster, tax evader, and it's a lie. Either he's lying or his lawyer has lied in court. For me, he's actually behaved worse than the last crowd that you had in, and certainly no better than Charles Green before him. Yet you ran Green out of town, you ran Easdale and Ashley out of town, and you love this guy.
No, but before, again, it's different points, but before I've heard an argument, it makes the Rangers fans who say the same. Oh, the SFA should have stopped Craig White, and you guys are Craig White. Well, if the SFA tried to stop Craig White, what would the Rangers fans' reaction to that have been? Would they have said, oh, that's fine?
Well, the SFA should have stopped Dave King.
Yeah, the fit and proper.
He failed three of their five criteria for fit and proper.
What I find, again, different subjects, but I find the basis upon which Dave King rode into town with grand promises has been completely undermined by what's happened subsequently. Now, the argument against that is that they still have a rights issue and he can shell out a lot of money there. Well, let's wait and see.
But he can't have a rights issue.
But I don't think they're...
Can't have a rights issue until he's no longer at the club.
Well, they first have to vote to have one, which they've failed to do in the last 2 years.
But even then, until he's no longer at the club, unless he fulfils his legal obligations, to make a full offer.
Well, that's still, you still haven't, you still haven't had a verdict on that stuff, memory.
Well, the takeover panel's declared, yeah, and he's going to appeal it. It's all chaos it breaks loose if the court overturns the decision of the takeover panel.
But as I say, I think the noise around this takeover has not been backed up with what's happened since. That's what I was saying.
No, but the Rangers fans.
Anyway, my point is that the Rangers fans will and do have a go at the media for the coverage, and Celtic fans have a go at the media for their coverage of Rangers. I get that.
But actually, I would say in defence of the media for the Rangers fan position, that's because Scottish football never actually grasped the nettle of saying, you guys went bust. You went bust because you spent money you shouldn't have spent. You spent, ended up, was it Rangers in liquidation are currently at minus £90 million or something like that? So they went bust for a reason. It's not like they had a basketball and an ice hockey team and a football team, and the basketball and the ice hockey team racked up all these debts, and there's a bit of sympathy that then mutated across the Rangers.
I don't think they get much sympathy.
No, but I don't see any merit in their argument. The reason why they believe that is because there's not been a forceful enough position to go across and say, no, you guys, that's the consequences of spending money illegally.
I'm not sure about that. I think, to be fair, a lot of Rangers fans would acknowledge. Again, you have to be careful. There's noise and shouting. I think Rangers fans would acknowledge their own club's obviously key role in what happened. I don't think there's
the point. Any time I speak to a Rangers fan, I usually let it go. But if they really start bugging me, the point I mention the week is all the rules were broken. Rangers should have started with a Gretner. So instead of whinging about it, they should be eternally grateful to Scottish football that they didn't put them down with a Gretner and basically make them not exist. They bent the rules to have Rangers go in the bottom tier. There was no rule that allowed Rangers. There was only a rule that they could have kept Rangers in the SPL.
Yeah. Or
Rangers didn't exist, and they bent all the rules to put them in the bottom tier of Scottish football
because of the value of the football club, obviously.
Yeah.
The value of them to the game.
I get that. But the point being, so every day that they whinge, they should be reminded rules were broken to keep them there.
Again, I'm not sure they're whinging. I kind of get the feeling that's, there's another thing going back to the media. I got the impression a while ago people in England switched off to Rangers. They kind of say, if I'm down there, they'll ask, what you might get asked, what's happening with Rangers now? But I think ages ago they kind of came out of it, and I think I make this point, and obviously I get stick for it as well, I think so many people in Scotland switched off to it as well. I think they think, now that's not to say they're saying Rangers are paragons of virtue and did nothing wrong and blah blah blah. I just think the whole story around it bored people at a point quite a while ago, actually.
I absolutely think that.
And again, that's not to say, for example, I thought what Graeme Souness said last week was ludicrous about Scottish football will die. I mean, that's patent nonsense without Rangers.
But then this is the other point of them.
So what I'm saying is there's a middle ground, I think, that gets lost. Yeah,
but what frustrates me, I understand why you wouldn't, because I don't know if I would want to say, I wouldn't want to be as close as I am to you, to Graeme Souness, full stop. But I wouldn't want to be as close as I am to you, Graeme Souness, and say, after Graeme Souness says, need a strong Rangers, blah, 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 to say, oh, while we're talking about Rangers, see, when you're a manager of another football club, why did you get a payment from Rangers? I don't know if I'd want to be brave enough to ask that question. And then when he tries to deny it, say no, when he tries to come up with the only time he's ever been asked that and comes up with some cock and bull about it was between clubs. No. You were manager of Blackburn at the time. How did the people of Blackburn think about the fact that you were being paid by Rangers just after you'd signed a Rangers player?
I just find this assertion about.
So then what bugs me is don't interview him unless you're prepared to ask him that question. That would be my point. What value is there to ask? For me, the most newsworthy thing you could ask Graeme Souness is...
Aye, to you, though. Only to you.
Not only to me.
Not only to you, sorry, that's unfair. But to some people, that would be news. To other people, they would say it. Who cares? Genuinely, that's what people would think.
Well, right...
My contention with what you said is... I don't even mind them saying needs a strong Rangers, though I disagree with that. But anyway, that you can debate that point. But the point is, he says Scottish football will die without.
Yeah.
Well, Rangers were in the lower leagues, and Scottish football's
best thing that happened to Scottish football.
But Scottish football's still here, and always will be still here. It won't die regardless of who's challenging for championships. I actually found that kind of offensive point. I thought, well, right, you know, I don't know. I really objected to that kind of language, and maybe I would hope he regrets using that language. But I'm not sure he would.
No, I don't think he would. I thought Willie Miller was brilliant on Sports Sound about it. Willie Miller and Tom English, but mainly Willie Miller said, that is everything that's wrong with Rangers.
But again, he doesn't represent Rangers anymore, does he?
No. But he was saying that's a common thing you hear from Rangers people. Mm. And that's what's wrong with Rangers. It's an entitlement issue. Oh, and he said everything that's happened to Rangers was their own fault. Well, they brought it on themselves.
Well, definitely was. We know there was at Watts football through the 90s. There was an entitlement thing with Rangers. And that's why, and again, I've written about this, when Rangers fell into such chaos and trouble, the rest of Scottish football, who really had their noses rubbed in it for years, said, oh, all right, is that what happens now, is it? There wasn't going to be widespread sympathy.
Yeah.
Because people remember what it was like when it was that we're too big for Scottish football, we're big business, we're going to do this, that and the other. So, and that came round, and that's just a natural emotion from people who would say, well, how did that work out for you? But I'm not sure Graeme Souness anymore represents that. Now, I think it's maybe unfair to say people at the club represent that. I don't really get that impression.
It's the noise you hear from all people who are from the Rangers side.
You have to be careful with noise, don't you? That's what I'm saying. Sometimes it masks what the...
But they never even say... No, but you do get a new manager come. A new manager will come in and immediately start talking about challenging Celtic.
Mm-hmm. But then he'll be asked that again. That's a slight. I don't want to say a media failing. He will be asked immediately about challenging Celtic.
And if I was the new Rangers manager, and if I was the PR people of Rangers, first thing I would say is, first of all, we've got to catch Aberdeen.
Yeah. Well, the reason I think Rangers is a good job for someone is that for the resources they're spending, they should be second in the league. They should win the odd cup. Look at teams that have won cups over the last 6 years. Rangers haven't won any. So you can make that improvement.
Mm-hmm.
Get them, dare I say, in the group stages of the Europa League. And then people say, oh, that'll never be good enough for Rangers. Well, it would, because that's progress just now.
Yeah, but then that's about expectation setting.
Yeah, but questions are getting asked about challenging Celtic, and I think Rangers manager says, inevitably, yes, we can challenge Celtic soon. Well, it's because they're getting asked that. What are they going to say?
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. You turn that round and say...
Absolutely no chance.
That's our long-term ambition, but first and foremost, the most important thing is we've got a good challenge from Hibs, Hearts, St Johnstone, Motherwell, Aberdeen. There are teams around us in the top half of the league, and our first target has got to be to finish above those teams.
Yeah.
Then we can take stock and assess what we do.
That's perfectly fair. But, again, I'm just saying the phrasing of the questioning might make that not what is... portrayed. I felt sorry for Cassina at his unveiling because he was asked about the squad and this thing about I've got the best squad, and he then came and sat with the newspapers and explained, look, I will always say that he wasn't that stupid that he thought Rangers are the best squad in the league.
Mm-hmm.
But he said it, and whether you agree with him or not, his rationale was, I will always believe the players I have are the best in the country, and that's what I try to tell them, they're the best. And this thing ran and ran and ran, and I thought, well, there's a lot of things that hit Pedro Cassina about. He clearly wasn't cut out for what he was doing. But I thought that was...
But then I know someone... I remember doing someone at the time who knew Paul Lambert. And if you remember when Martin O'Neill came in, Martin O'Neill said, Rangers are the benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to improve to get up.
Jake Levine says it about Aberdeen, for example, for Hearts.
And then Martin O'Neill sat down with the players and said, I'll always tell you the truth, and I'll always be truthful to the press, but I have just told a lie. You guys are better than Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
He told them privately.
Mm-hmm.
To avoid the ridicule in public. In public he was saying Rangers are up there, we've got to catch them. He then takes the players aside and says, just to let you know, I had to say that, but the real thing is I believe you're better than them already.
Yeah, good management.
Yeah,
what's the difference?
So what do you see happening this season for all Scottish football, and this season, the next couple of seasons?
In what context?
You mean like continued domination of Celtic? Do you think Celtic will win the treble, go unbeaten?
I didn't think Celtic were playing, I don't use the word nearly, I don't think they were playing as well at the start of this season as they had last season until that night in Aberdeen,
mm-hmm.
where they were excellent. That's the best I've seen them play in ages. So, of course they'll win the league. Could Motherwell beat them in the League Cup final? Don't think so. Could someone else win the Scottish Cup? Possibly, yeah.
Well, all you need is a game in the Cup where we put in the performance against Kilmarnock and the penalty decision that Hibs got in the Cup semi-final. Those two things together, and we get knocked out.
Yeah, it can happen. Well, look at... And I use this again in defence of what Celtic have done, that there aren't many historic trebles throughout Scottish football. The perception of the Old Firm dominating, which is largely right, but they haven't won treble after treble after mm-hmm. treble after treble after treble. So that shows you things can happen. The debate would be, is Celtic's gulf now far bigger than any other ones have ever been, which is very hard to assess. But they'll keep winning the championship, of course.
Money-wise, it is.
Yeah. And it's... You know, Celtic are paying players 30 times what Ross County or St Johnstone have played them, and that's an incredible gulf. Again, I stress, not Celtic's fault, not Celtic's problem, not anything for Celtic to worry about.
Which reminds me, I think you were one of the people who wrote the thing about the differential between Celtic and when Celtic could be differential between Celtic and PSG is similar to the differential between Celtic and Ross County.
No, I just thought it's Ross County there. But I don't know.
No,
I need to think about that.
Because the point I would make is it's a bigger gulf between Celtic and PSG and Celtic and Ross County. Because football's a game of weakest links. And Ross County could afford to pay the wages of our cheapest player in our squad. We couldn't afford to pay the wages of the cheapest player.
Who would the cheapest player in Celtic?
Some of our youth players will be on.
Their youth players are different.
No, but
they couldn't afford.
Someone like Tony Ralston. The next game we played Tony Ralston against Ross County.
Yeah, but first
Ross County could afford to pay Tony Ralston's wages.
But not their weakest first team player. I don't think that was. Celtic, and they couldn't afford anything like near Beaton's wages or Christian Gamboa's wages or.
No, but the point being, there are players who play around the Celtic first team squad that the other teams in Scottish football could afford their wages. There is nobody playing around the first team squad of PSG that we could afford.
Nobody?
Nobody.
So there's nobody at PSG earning 35 grand a week? I'm not sure about that. I don't know. I would need to look at the. I've got a bee in my bonnet about this. I keep reading and hearing about what X amount of players get paid. You don't really know,
no,
do you?
No, you don't know. No, I read a thing yesterday about.
I mean, you see total staff costs now, but we don't know.
Kieran Tierney's contract being 18 grand rising to 25. Unless Kieran Tierney's walked outside and said to someone, there's my contract, there's all my details. Nobody knows that.
And that's also interesting because it's such a long period of time. I mean, you.
And the only thing I can think of is that, because we've just done a few players with new contracts, the only thing I can think of is we're inserting new buyout clause prices in players' contracts.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. Listen, sometimes I've heard it. Sometimes a manager will tell you what a player gets paid, so you would know. But now I see as routine players' wages splattered all over the internet. You don't know that.
I remember working with a guy who used to be at the Co-op Bank and was talking about, you know, he then left and he said, you know, he was talking about Pavel Berkovic.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he's on this and he's on that, but all the other benefits, we estimated that to actually get his standard of life with all the other benefits like flights for his family, it was pushing a cost of about 60 grand a week, although his salary was 25. So it's all those other things that you then
clubs have paid mortgages, clubs give cars, clubs there's bonuses, clubs, but and also clubs also used to, I've got shares and Hearts, I always get the accounts, but it used to break down the costs in terms of what was players.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's just now all clubs give you a staff cost.
Yeah, football. Yeah, staff cost.
Aberdeen's an interesting one because it's about £8 or £9 million. Now that's quite high, but I don't know the breakup.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Yeah,
they could be paying the club shop manager £200 grand a year.
That's £2 million on £1 million tonight.
Well, you know, it would be good if that was broken down, but clubs don't do that anymore.
So back to this season.
Yeah,
Celtic going to win the treble, go unbeaten.
I'm not sure they'll win. I wouldn't bet on them winning the next two trebles, put it that way. It's likely, of course it is. Mm-hmm. Law of averages. And a lot depends on who Rangers hire as a manager. In terms of making them stronger for, as I say, cup competitions. I mean, if I know Celtic have changed, but I mean, who have won cups in the last 6 years? Ross County, Inverness, St Mirren, St Johnstone have all won trophies.
Mm-hmm.
So Rangers still, for the amount of wages they are paying out, notwithstanding what they need to get rid of, whatever else, I think should be able to win a trophy somewhere. Hearts have never won the League Cup since 1962. I would love to see that happening, but I've almost given up on it. And I think Aberdeen's future depends on whether Derek McInnes will go to Rangers or not and what they do about that. I think it'll be interesting to see if Steve Clarke does it come on it, because that looks a really good appointment to me.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see whether the short term buzz that Motherwell are having can be sustained. And also, what I think this season is a bit sad is that you can't deny the brilliant job Tommy Wright's done at St Johnstone, and now it seems to be going a bit wrong.
Yeah, and I hope scored in 500 minutes or something.
And I hope that doesn't end, I don't say anything badly, but for all, you know, the good things Tommy Wright's done at St Johnstone, I hope that doesn't end in tears, because he deserves better than that for all the work he's done. And I hope Michael O'Neill is a new Scotland manager. That sort of thing. Got every base covered.
That's enough. Yes, with that I will see you, money. Thanks very much. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. I know it was really long, and I did think about editing it down, but
quite frankly, I couldn't be bothered. Anyway, Celtic FC Foundation events coming up. Today, as we record this and put this out, it is just before, hopefully, we break the 100-year record of undefeated domestic performances. So on Monday is, of course, the anniversary, the 130th anniversary of our club. So we have the homeless lunch on Monday and then the Founding Fathers Mass at St Mary's on Monday evening. And I think anyone is free to go along. As Tony Hamilton would say, all faiths or none. There is also the Founding Fathers Fast if you want to participate in that. Go on to the Celtic FC Foundation website and you'll find details of everything that they are on and up to, and I think the Christmas appeal has now been launched as well. So go on to the Celtic FC Foundation website and you'll see everything there. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night.
Give love a guarantee to last through forever, another day.
As today I know I'm living for tomorrow. Yeah. Give me the past, but that I mustn't feel, 'cause you're here.
Now I know deep in my mind the love of me I felt behind.
Love them.